This message is the property of H. David Edwards and Elam Bible Institute, and presented free of charge for private use only. Permission to use this message publicly may be requested by contacting Elam Bible Institute at 7245 College Street, Lima, New York, 14485.
If it were not for the constraint that I feel by virtue of the preparation that I've undertaken in order to prepare myself, I'd gladly surrender my assignment this morning to any volunteer. To be asked to speak to pastors on the question of the pastor and elders is almost as dangerous as to be asked to interpret the symbolic significance of elders in the book of the Revelation. I think, in fact, that latter task might be one that would be a little easier than the one that's assigned to me today. You will all have heard, of course, of the little boy who decided that he did not want to go to heaven because he had heard that there were going to be 24 elders there. I talked with a friend of mine, very active in a pastoral ministry recently. When we began the conversation in the morning, I said, "How is it going?" He said, "Do you want me to tell you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I wish that I had never heard of elders." Now, I rather imagine that to some degree that is a reaction that is not uncommon. I have no doubt that there are some brethren who, having been exposed to some fairly recent and for them novel ideas concerning the question of presbyters, have experimented with their introduction, perhaps to their hurt. However, the fact that that is so is no justification for our glossing over the scriptural principles which appear to be involved in the ministry of elders. Now, I covet your sympathy this morning. I recognize that for some of you, what I am about to say will be controversial, but that will not surprise you, seeing that it's me. And if I were only to say the things that you were already aware of, that is not to say that our time would be wasted. It's good that our pure minds should be stirred up by way of remembrance. But it's also good that if there are any facets of any problem which perhaps we appear to overlook, it's good that we should have our attention drawn to them, and maybe that we should be obliged to think in some different directions. I want to talk to you about why we have them, who they are, and what they do, or else their necessity, their qualifications, and their function. The why. Personally, I do not regard the church as a free association able at whim to establish its own ecclesiastical Robert's rules of order and procedure and to solicit her own offices. The church is not a voluntary organization. She is more than a voluntary organization of the recognizably disobedient who are anticipating heaven. Now, for some, she is no more than that. But biblically, the church is more than that. The church is no more free to choose her administrators than I am free to choose my head, this head, or my personality free to choose any other body as its dwelling place and means of expression. The church is bound, not by legislation, but by life, to her own head, without whose breath she not only had no beginning, but she has no continuance and no guaranteed end. The church is the church of God, purchase of his own blood, work of his own hands, vehicle of his own purpose, and is no more capable of self-sustenance than you are capable of unaided flight to the moon. Now, if you consider that you are capable, that is only to indicate that you haven't yet experimented. I have known for years that I am capable of unaided flight. The only thing that I have lacked to this stage is the courage to initiate such a venture. The idea occurred to me when I was about 4 years of age, and I stood at the top of the 18 steps that led from the second floor of our home to the first. And I knew that if I had the courage to launch myself into space, I should make a graceful three-point landing on the mat at the foot of the stairs. Fortunately, my courage never got to that point. The church is under necessity, if not under oath of fidelity, to submit herself to her master's hands and provision for her well-being. She is under obligation to his holy law, not only to refrain from what it forbids, but to implement what it requires. It is not sufficient for us to anticipate an ideal church in some far-off eternity, nor is it reasonable for us to say our perfections are spiritual or heavenly or imputed. It is my opinion that as in that glorious day of his incarnation there was a remarkable blending of divine and human, so that the human remained real, more real than my humanity, and the divine not robbed of its deity, yet one, so the church is intended to be visible, having a unity and a glory, a power and an authority, which can be seen by unregenerate eyes, even if it is not always recognized, and yet be manifestly human, with powers and graces that bespeak her supernatural origins and continuing support. It's not our church. We are not at liberty to choose the way in which we will be administered. Nor are we at liberty to choose our own administrators. The kind of relationship that we have with our head, if it is to be sustained, requires that we submit ourselves to that headship and allow him to provide for his administration of what we confess to be his body. How would you like someone else to endeavor to take up residence in your body? Does she always have the same administrative patterns? Is there some essential element without which she is no longer the church? Now, personally, I consider one essential for the existence of the church, and I do not consider charismatic gifts or ascension gifts, if you speak of them as that, or elders, as necessary for the church. The only thing that is necessary for the church is his presence, not our presence. And the ministry of elders is not as much required as his ministry is required. However, I must ask myself whether or not, as there is perhaps some essential element without which she is no longer the church, is there equally any pattern or procedure which, if persisted in, so nullifies this essence as to negate her existence? Is there something which is an imperative? Is there anything which, if present, means the absence of that imperative? That God can and does take advantage of a variety of administrative patterns seems to me to be clear both from Scripture and history. Does that mean that he is indifferent? That there is no pattern or ideal? That the scriptural variety arises from development, the difference being only varying stages? Or does God accommodate himself to whatever ecclesiastical pattern is best suited to the culture and needs of the moment? I am of the opinion that the ambiguity, if there be any, serves two not unrelated ends. Not all the T's are crossed, and not all the I's are dotted. Lest we should become so sure of precipitating God's intervention, both dramatic and continued, as we are sure of the outcome of a chemical experiment which carefully follows previously discovered and determined laws. Such a situation would leave no room for his sovereign intervention, and it is difficult for me to find a place of faith in such a rigid situation. There is an ambiguity which surrounds the question of church structure. Now, I have asked myself, and I ask you in this paragraph, which includes a couple of questions, whether or not that is accidental, whether or not it is an indication that as far as God is concerned, it doesn't matter, or whether or not the varying patterns that we find are an indication of development. I think, as I have said, that it serves one purpose. But God hasn't left us with enough pieces to make a box in which we can lock him, nor enough to make a box in which we can be secure of finding him. Conversely, however, sufficient is known for us to discover to our mutual awareness whether or not we are prepared to submit ourselves to his provision. Now, this is the other side of the coin. It seems to me that not only has he and does he wink at our ignorance, how much out of mercy and how much out of amusement, we don't know, but also that the flexibility within limits that seems to be indicated in his word provides both for his gracious intervention and for our faith. Now, where the boundaries of this flexibility lie, I am not sure. Except that, in my opinion, any situation which denies the real expression of the Spirit of God in another, however that is done, if persisted in, eventually so hurts the relationship as to make it non-Christian. If I establish a system, or the absence of a system, which denies the possibility of the Spirit of God in another, then I think that that association, however grandiose a title it might bear, does not warrant the name of the Church of God. I'd like to draw your attention to a number of scriptures which speak of that particular form of ministry or aspect of function with which we are concerned this morning. And I recognize that in by referring you to some of these scriptures in the light of what I will say later, it might be seen in retrospect that I am out to deceive you, but let me assure you that that is not so. For some of these scriptures, which at this stage I would suggest seem to establish the necessity of elders, will, as we come back to look at them later, perhaps serve to contradict that. Come with me. Acts 14:23, when they had ordained elders in every church and had prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believed. It occurs to me as I read this verse that they commended them to the Lord and not to the elders. Acts 15:4, and when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. And verse 6, and the apostles and elders came together to consider of this matter. And chapter 20. Verse 17. From Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called the elders of the church. And verse 28, take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit hath made you overseers, to feed the church of God which he hath purchased with his own blood. James 5:14, which you will all be familiar with by virtue of your taking advantage of it at some time or other, either to receive or else to contribute. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church. 1 Peter 5. The elders who are among you I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight of it, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. Titus 1:5. For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city, as I had appointed thee. Hebrews 13:17, obey them that have the rule over you, and submit yourselves, for they watch for your soul as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. 1 Thessalonians 5:12-13, and we beseech you, brethren, to know them who labor among you and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. 1 Timothy 5:17, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. It is not that the church is incapable of choosing her own administrators and ministers, but that when she does, she is acting in a manner which denies her essential relationship to her Lord. And when this happens so that those who should serve do not, and those who do serve should not, they and those whom they seek to serve are hurt. I heard Brother David Schock say some years ago that to offer to the Lord a form of worship other than that what he requires is idolatry. Remembering the biblical association or connection between idolatry and adultery, I would suggest for you that idolatry is to anticipate from some other what he exclusively promises to provide, and adultery is to yield to another what he exclusively anticipates to receive. And that possibly in selecting her own administrators and ministers, we are guilty of both idolatry and adultery. Inasmuch as we expect from them what God alone has promised to provide, and we yield to them what he alone requires to receive. When his headship is denied, it is no longer his church. So much for the necessity. Who are they? Why do we have them? Who are they? I would suggest for you that they are the contemporary cloud of witnesses. They are not spectators, but evidences, not only of the validity of the life that we share, but of the real possibility of attaining the goals that we together pursue. I want you to listen carefully. They are those in whom time and the grace of God, by His Spirit through His Word, have had an opportunity of so relating as to produce manifest evidences of that holy character and disposition which it is His expectation all His children will ultimately share. That's who the elders are. The elders are those in whom time, that is an essential element, not to be done away with, created by God for this purpose. They are those in whom time and the grace of God, by His Spirit, through His Word, have had an opportunity of so relating as to produce manifest evidences of that holy character and disposition which it is His expectation all His children will ultimately share. That is not to say that the elders have arrived at the place towards which we are all headed, but they have made more progress than the rest of us. If they have not, they do not deserve the designation elders. In the light of what I am about to say, I should correct that and say bishops. However, don't let that throw you. That's not intended as a curve. Not only has time and grace combined in them to produce character, but there has been sufficient time for that character to be evidenced as no flash in the pan. Any one of us can be holy for some time, provided the motivation is strong enough. But these are those who do not only testify to time, but to whom time testifies that no reasonable investigation will uncover any skeletons. You could love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind for 5 minutes if I held a pistol to your head and threatened you with immediate extinction if you didn't. You would. But the elders are those who have given evidence not only to time, but to whom time gives evidence that their character is no flash in the pan. In some senses and to some degree, They are those who stand not only over us, but ahead of us, who urge us on, saying, it's all right, you can make it. If I have made it, you can make it. When they are over us, we must not regard them as despots. They must genuinely be our superiors, better than we are, who constantly, by word and life, urge us to accompany them, so that they, in biblical phrase, might bring us whither he himself would come. It is not enough for an elder to excel. He must seek to excel in ensuring that others surpass the excellence he has attained to. They must be the kind of men on whom you cannot lay a finger. They must not only be beyond the evidence, they must be beyond the suspicion of an accusation. We speak of some men and we say, you can't lay a finger on him. What we really mean by that is that we are suspicious, but we don't have enough evidence. In Scottish justice, there is a verdict which is called not proven. What that means is that we know that you did it, but we can't prove it. Now, when I say that an elder must be the kind of man on whom you cannot lay a finger, I mean they must not only be beyond the evidence, they must be beyond the suspicion of the accusation, above reproach. I think, as you must, of those men who eventually have hurt rather than helped the church, because alongside their obviously pneumatic charismatic ministries, there have been equally obvious flaws, which we have been inclined to overlook because, as we say, of the grace of God. I think of men who have been widely acclaimed in that connection. And behind our hands and behind closed doors, we speak of the numerous secretaries that they have, or else of the way in which they handle their finances. Eventually, regardless of the immediate impact of their ministry, such men hurt and hinder rather than help the Church of God. I think conversely of certain men of whom we have been inclined to say they have nothing to offer except a godly life, as though there were anything more within which to commend and to adorn the gospel. I think of two significant men of these decades of this century about whom and against whom I have heard no suggestion of scandal, either of money or maids. Orla Roberts and Billy Graham. I have not at any time heard the slightest whisper of anything that would tarnish their reputations. And if you have, I don't want to hear it. I don't wonder, then, that they are as influential as they are. Ideally, an elder is a man of such a caliber that any accusation made against his character is laughed out of court as being wholly inconsistent with all the known facts. My immediate reaction, brethren, is that I have, and that I do disqualify myself. The requirements of elders for bishops are exclusively character qualifications.
not pneumatic or obviously charismatic. Now, when that first occurred to me, some maybe 5 or 6 years ago, my immediate response was, oh no! My response nowadays is, oh yes. At that time, I was obliged to wonder why it was that the deacons, as we call them, of Acts 6, were required to be full of the Spirit, as well as of good report, whereas no such requirement was made of elders who would aspire to be bishops. There is nothing more required of elders who would be bishops than a pastor would look for in all the members of his congregation. Except that they have it par excellence. And it would certainly be true to say that if the opposite of the positives, or else the presence of the negatives in that list of qualifications, were found in any member of your congregations, you would be concerned for their lack of growth in Christian grace. That is some indication of how far we have come. And it is a proof of how genuinely we have been the salt of the earth.
I think we should recognize too that these are not requirements that the position imposes on him, but virtues which must be recognized in him before he is offered the position. We are inclined to say, maybe if we do ordain him, the very fact of being in that position will change him. That's not the scriptural approach. The scriptural approach might rather be, if he hasn't got it beforehand, he's hardly likely to have it afterwards. Let's review briefly those 16 characteristics of elders who would be bishops, which might give a clue to those of you who think of the way in which we are headed. 10 positive and 6 negative. Those 6 negative, carefully chosen, and of such a kind that they cannot be spoken of as positives. He is blameless. I'm reading, of course, from 1 Timothy. And taking account as well of similar requirements that are expressed in Titus. Blameless, unrebukable, that cannot be laid hold of. Not that he's a slippery customer, but that search how you might, there are no grounds whatsoever for accusing him of impropriety in any of the areas which are afterwards very carefully catalogued. Let me ask you, brethren, that we together take time to determine whether or not we, as leaders, measure up to these requirements that are imposed upon us by the Scripture if we are effectively to be an example to the flock.
It is not enough for us that in one area we are beyond detection. That is all that it might be. We've covered our tracks. We're far enough away from the scene of the crime as never again to be related to it. That is not what he has in mind. And it might well be that when he says beyond reproach or blameless, he is not thinking of a characteristic, but a standard which is to be related to all the following characteristics. That in connection with his house and with the scriptures and with other servants, he is to be blameless. That there is no facet of his life which could not submit itself to scrutiny. And a Senate inquiry, or an inquiry into the activities of the FBI or the CIA, is as nothing compared to the scrutiny which we will be called to undergo one of these days. Blameless. Not open to censure. A synonym is used when it is required of widows who are to receive benevolence from the assembly. It is suggested of deacons, 1 Timothy 3:10, of all, 1 Corinthians 1:8 and Colossians 1:22. A position not open to attack. A man beyond criticism, unable to be found fault with, affording no hold to an adversary. John Poole spoke to us last night of the charges that were laid against the Apostle Paul. Nothing was said about his character. I remember when I was Dean of Men, I'd heard that one of the fellows had been up to something or other which I should investigate, so I sent for him. When he sat down facing me, I said, "Do you have anything that you'd like to share with me?" He heaved a big sigh and he said, "Well, I suppose I'd better get it off my chest." And then for 40 minutes I listened to one of the most gruesome and blood-curdling accounts of student misdemeanor that it's ever been my pleasure to listen to. Now that was not at all the kind of thing that I had in mind when I spoke to him. And when it was all over, I said, "Let me tell you what it was that I wanted to discuss with you." And it was like being apprehended by a cop for a parking ticket, and then out of guilt, confessing to murder. Now, an elder must be the kind of man in whom there is aroused no suspicion when a question like that is put to him. I heard of one prankster who addressed identical cables to 12 of his friends who were men of reputation, or so was supposed. And the cable said, "All is discovered. Flee the country." 11 of them have not been heard of since. I recall reading how in Florida, the electric company, in excavating for a new power line, cut the water main. In the next 45 minutes, 60 people paid their bills at the office. An elder is a man who is blameless, beyond the possibility of censure. in all the areas which are afterwards listed for us. The husband of one wife, a requirement which is capable of interpretation in five different ways. No wonder we hassle over it. For some people, this means that he must be married. For others, it means that he must not be a polygamist. For others, it means that he must not be a digamist. Now, you all know what a digamist is, don't you? A digamist is a man who has a second spouse after the death of his first. A bigamist is a man who has a second spouse before the death of his first. A digamist is a man who has a spouse after the death of his first. For others, it is held that he must not be a divorced man. For others, it means that he must be above reproach in this area. Now, I consider that this latter is the only definition that harmonizes with all the scriptures. It can't mean that he must not be a polygamist, because a similar word is used of a woman in 5:19, where it is said that she must be the wife of one husband. And although polygamy was known, polyandry, which is one wife having more than one husband, was not known. I don't think it can be interpreted, as it is by some, that he must not be a digamist. For in this same epistle, Paul urges widows that they remarry. And he adopts a similar position in Romans 7. Nor do I consider that he must not be a divorced man. For my position is, and I only ask that you should accept this as my opinion, I'm not imposing it upon you, that if divorce is secured for biblical grounds, it means the end of the marriage as though it had terminated in death, leaving the partners free to remarry. I think that what Paul is saying here is that in an age when marriage is questioned, the marriage of an elder must be of such a kind as to carry no slur. And it ought to be of such a kind as to put him beyond the possibility of being an easy prey to temptation. I say that in the light of our contemporary society. He must not be a ladies' man. He might be a gentleman, but he must not be a ladies' man. Mothers, sisters, wives, and daughters should be grateful. Chastity is owed to the Christian church. Herod had 9 wives. An elder must be as a rock when the tide of uncleanness sweeps in. It is a remarkable witness to this injunction that bigamy is now illegal in Christian countries. He must be vigilant, translated sober. He must be wary, unimpassioned, not credulous. For if he is credulous, his even more credulous sheep will surely follow him. That is not to say that he must be a suspicious man, but he must not be easily taken in, not duped. You ought not to be able to sell the Brooklyn Bridge to an elder. Sober, which is translated discreet,
temperate, to be in one's right mind, to be sober-minded, to be of a sound mind, prudent, self-controlled, not swayed by sudden impulses over which he has no mastery. A discipline and self-control which holds the reins over passions and desires. An elder should be the kind of man in this connection whose wife does not mind if he accompanies her to the supermarket. I know some ladies who find that their grocery bill is doubled if they are accompanied by their husbands. Because everything that is available is a temptation to them. Here is a man who doesn't go running for every bargain sale, of good behavior, found only here and in 1 Timothy 2:9, where it is required of ladies, modest, orderly, decorous, used to describe the man who is a good citizen, the citizen who is quiet in the land, who duly fulfills in his place and order the duties which are incumbent upon him as a good citizen. I quote Plato via William Barclay. Given to hospitality, Romans 12:13, hospitality is an obligation which is imposed upon all of us. Again in 1 Peter 4:9 and Hebrews 13. There was no franchise available for Holiday Inn. Those hotels that were available were usually dirty, expensive, and immoral. And so there sprang up what were known as guest friendships. Families arranged for interchange of hospitality and accommodation, provided for tallies, which were a half of one object easily identified, or else something like a ring which bore the signet or seal of the family, the crest. Oftentimes families so connected grew apart and were not recognized except by the tally, which was still honored. Given to hospitality. Hospitable both to wandering preachers and persecuted Christians. In that connection, I consider that the word angels in Hebrews 13, in that connection, is better translated messengers. And then we understand it of entertaining these messengers rather than these messengers. Apt to teach. Preach to the unconverted and teach the converted. One who does not sit long in his cups, as we might paraphrase the requirement, not given to wine. It is difficult, taking account of all the scriptures, to build a position of total abstinence. That is my opinion. However, there is no question about the fact that the scriptures command that drunkenness should not be known amongst believers. Paul speaks of it in Ephesians 5:18, 1 Timothy 3:8, Titus 2:3, where he relates it to ladies. of bishops, 1 Timothy 3:3, to which we are addressing ourselves, and Titus 1:7. Not a striker. That has nothing to do with having a dispute with your employer, but it means one not given to settling an argument with his fists. One in whose life the use of force is excluded or precluded. Following the example of the lamb led to the slaughter, he gave his back to the smiters, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. And how those verses in Peter have spoken to me recently. Submitting ourselves to our employers, not only to those who are benevolent, but also to those who are demanding and extortionate. That we do not use force to attain our ends. Not greedy of filthy lucre. The ministry provides opportunity for this temptation and is one of Satan's favorite weapons. Pride, passion, and your pocketbook are the three avenues of approach that he makes most use of. Once a teacher sets his eyes on silver, it is easy for him to accommodate what he says to what he wants. We were talking yesterday about professional counseling. And one of the brethren made reference to a situation that he is personally acquainted with, where a man was obliged to take his wife to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, who said, "Of course I can handle her case. It will require 15 interviews at $30 a time. It's a little bit difficult to pronounce your patient cured in that kind of situation." Patient, not the usual word for patience, it means gentle. James 3:17 speaks of this as being a characteristic of the heavenly wisdom. Philippians 4:5 speaks of it as moderation. 2 Corinthians 10:1 speaks of it as the gentleness of Christ. Forbearing, considerate, not insisting on the letter of the law, conciliatory. Judgment by the letter of the law might be legally right, but morally wrong. This word has that kind of insight. Not a brawler, not contentious. A man can be this without giving way to his fists. He is rebuked. I remember that Brother Richard Fox told us that in the first church that it was his privilege to lead, there was a member of his board who introduced himself to Richard Fox with this comment, "I consider it to be my God-given mission to ensure that you will never have unity on this board." Not a nitpicker, not covetous, disinterested in material rewards or comforts. Hebrews 13 addresses itself to us, "Be content with such things as ye have." That's extremely difficult. I consider that this commandment is the one which is most frequently broken without disregard to the consequences, or to the fact that we are breaking the commandment. Thou shalt not covet. The whole of Madison Avenue is bent on encouraging you to break this commandment. Why bother keeping up with the Joneses? With just a little bit of extra effort, you could have them keeping up with you. First Timothy 6, verses 3 to 10, Hebrews 13, 5, 1 Peter 5, 2. One that ruleth well his own house. It seems to me that there is some indication in this requirement of the kind of situation that I spoke of when I said that time testifies to this man as well as he testifies to time. I think that when a man's children are 3 years of age, he's hardly had enough experience as yet to warrant your conclusion that he rules well his own house. Of course, if a man doesn't rule his own house well when his children are 3 years of age, it's obvious that he's excluded. But when his children are 3 years of age, there are certain pitfalls along the road that he hasn't yet learned to negotiate. I think that there must be behind the man a family record which is pretty clear before he meets this requirement. I wanted Paul to say, for if he doesn't rule his own house, how can he rule the church of God? But that isn't what he says. He says, if he doesn't rule his own house, how shall he care for the church of God? Because it is just possible that a man can assure himself of a good testimony in this regard by the kind of rule in his house which is hardly reflected by care in the church of God. But it must be the kind of rule in his house which, if carried over, becomes care in the church of God. And rule is care, not dogmatism or authoritarianism, but care. How shall he care for the church of God? Not a novice, not newly planted. That is, not new in Christian experience, and not new in Christian trials. 1 Timothy 6:4, 2 Timothy 3:4. Not high-minded, puffed up. If he becomes puffed up, he'll make a smoke, and he will fall the same way that Lucifer did, and in so doing expose the church to slanderers. He must have a good report from them that are without. I have some things to share with you which I would like you to consider sympathetically. And in this area, I will have to roam a little, and I trust that I have your permission. What I would like to suggest that you consider is that the elder is not to be identified with the bishop, and that neither are to be equated with the pastor. It is my opinion that all bishops are elders, but not all elders are bishops. And that whereas a pastor might be an elder, it is not a requirement that a man be an elder in order to be a pastor. Now, I don't know how drastic that kind of thinking is for you. And maybe you would wish that I could, or would, stop right here. But let me take you with me on the journey which led to this conclusion. Elder, the term, is not peculiar to the New Testament, nor is the office of elder peculiar to the New Testament. It is found a multitude of times in the Old Testament with varying degrees. Elders of tribes, elders of the nations, elders of the cities, elders of the towns, and elders of the house. Now, elders as such in the Old Testament are distinguished from people like princes and captains and judges and heads of tribes. And elders are distinguished repeatedly from people like Moses and Aaron and David. I've already made reference to the fact that in the list of requirements for an elder who would be a bishop, there is no reference to a charismatic endowment as such. But that all the requirements are those having to do with wisdom, character, personality, and relationship. In Numbers 11, verses 16, 24, and 25, we read of Moses' acceptance of the advice of his father-in-law and the separation of 70 elders to a peculiar status. All the elders of the nation, including elders of varying degrees of responsibility dependent upon whether they were elders of a household, a village, a city, a town, or a tribe, were gathered before him. And from all those elders, Moses then selected 70, laid his hands upon them in such a way that the spirit which was on him was now shared by them. They were elders before. I would suggest for you that now they become what we would call charismatic elders. They were elders before, but now they had something which they did not have before.